Welcome to Explorations in Music, a production of KALW in cooperation with San Francisco Performances, the Alexander String Quartet, and Dr. Robert Greenberg. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This season, a triangle for the ages. Today, we dig a little deeper into Johannes Brahms' history.
"And you, he cried menacingly, you who have been protected from everything coarse, you tell me I should have the same respect, the same exalted homage for women that you have? You expect that of a man cursed with a childhood like mine?"
Dr. Robert Greenberg holds a Ph.D. in music composition from the University of California at Berkeley, and since 1989 has been San Francisco Performance's music historian in residence. He has performed, taught, and lectured extensively in North America and Europe. The Alexander String Quartet is among the world's premier ensembles, maintaining a busy international touring and teaching schedule and recording for their own label, Foghorn Classics. Brahms truly had a deep and abiding love for Clara Schumann. But his early childhood experiences and the general sexist roles of the time combined to make his relationships with women very difficult. Here's Dr. Robert Greenberg.
We jump in. Some music, my friends. The opening of the sensational Hungarian gypsy-style dance that begins the fourth movement of Johannes Brahms's piano quartet in G minor. Now look, if you were able to sit still, if you were able to sit still during that excerpt, I would suggest you need to see a doctor. Now we have to talk now about Brahms and the ladies. Johannes Brahms and Clara Schumann fell in love with each other in 1854 when he was 21 years old and she was 35 years old. Whether they ever shared a bed, or a couch, or a kitchen counter, or a billiards table, is still unknown and will almost certainly remain unknown. Now, what we do know is that Brahms ended the romance between himself and Clara in 1856, and that event broke Clara's heart. Nevertheless, Brahms and Clara remained thorns in each other's sides for the remainder of their lives. It was a unique relationship for Brahms. It was his only long-term relationship with a woman who was not a member of his family. Yes, Brahms would eventually fall in love with other women, though none of these women remained in Brahms' life for very long. One of the reasons for this was Brahms' legendary, his fabled misogyny. It was a misogyny that uniquely didn't apply to Clara. She was for Brahms a great artist, a nurturing mother, a devoted wife, an idealized Madonna. Not so the other women in his life. Brahms's misogyny was partly a product of his 19th century German upbringing, but it was intensified a gazillionfold by his childhood experiences in the brothels of Hamburg. Every now and then, Brahms slipped and let down his emotional guard with often terrifying results. As an example, I offer up the following story told by Max Friedlander, a singer and musicologist and a very close friend of Brahms. I quote, "In the 1880s, I dined with Brahms at the house of one of his best Viennese friends, a man whose charming wife and two children made up the dinner party. Unfortunately, champagne was served. Brahms was usually a fairly temperate person. Well, three bottles of champagne were served to the six of us, and at dinner, we drank red wine. Brahms grew more and more silent. The talk turned on a beloved woman whom we all knew. Still, the master was silent until someone pressed him for his opinion of her. That was a moment that I shall never, ever forget. Abruptly, his harsh voice broke into a horrible, coarse tirade against this lady, broadening out to include women in general, and ended up by applying to them all an incredible, unspeakable epithet, a word so vile that I have never been able to repeat it, not even to my wife. Then Brahms fell back into his drunken silence. Our embarrassment was appalling. As soon as we rose from the table, I went up to the hostess and blurted out that I would be going now. But she begged me, 'For God's sake, please, don't leave us alone with him.' So I stayed. Brahms drank some black coffee and began to clear his head. We left together. On the street outside, I said goodbye, but he held on to me by the arm and said, 'Do you have any work you must do right now?' I said, 'No.' 'Then come with me to the park, will you?' I agreed. We trudged along in silence. At last, without turning towards me, he asked, 'Was it so very bad?' And I had to tell him, 'Yes, yes, it was very bad.' 'Look here,' he demanded abruptly, 'how were you raised?' So I told him of my childhood, how tenderly I was guarded from everything ugly and painful, and so on. Suddenly, Brahms burst out violently into my reminiscences, making a furiously angry scene in the middle of the park. 'And you, he cried menacingly, 'you who have been protected from everything coarse, you tell me I should have the same respect, the same exalted homage for women that you have? You expect that of a man cursed with a childhood like mine?' Then, with bitter passion, he recounted his poverty-stricken youth in the slums of Hamburg. How, as a child, he was already a competent pianist, and how his father would drag him from bed to play for dancing prostitutes and to accompany obscene songs in the most depraved dives in the St. Pauli Quarter. That's the waterfront quarter. 'Do you know these places?' he demanded. 'Only from the outside.' 'Then you can't have the least idea of what they are really like.' And in those days, they were still worse. They were filled with the lowest sort of public women, the so-called singing girls. When the sailing ships made port, the sailors would rush out like beasts of prey looking for these women. And these half-dressed girls, to make those men still wilder, used to take me on their laps between dances, kiss and caress and excite me. That was my first impression of the love of women. And you expect me to honor them as you do?" It was a long time before Brahms finally simmered down. All right, unquote. Brahms carried with him the shame and humiliation he suffered as a child at the hands of Hamburg's prostitutes for his entire life. Now, here's what we know. In early 1846, at the age of 12, Brahms's father began to hire his son out as a pianist in the dives around the Hamburg waterfront. Child endangerment, we righteously and correctly cry here in our enlightened little bubble. But this, my friends, was the 1840s. The Brahms family was desperately poor, and it was a given that once he was able to do so, Johannes was going to contribute to the family's economic well-being by playing the piano for money. Now, no doubt, Brahms's parents were guilty of colossal stupidity. But in those days of child labor and workhouses, so was the rest of European society. Brahms's parents loved their children. But in sending little Hannes out to play in the brothels, they made a singular mistake. That the dives of the Hamburg waterfront district were euphemistically called Animer Lokal, which means stimulation pubs. There were combinations dance halls, bars, restaurants, and whorehouses, and the singing girls who populated them were combinations waitresses, singers, dancers, and whores. The pianist in such an establishment played all night for $2 und 1, for $2 and all you can drink. Later in his life, Brahms told a friend that he, quote, had seen things that left a deep shadow on my mind, unquote, according to Brahms's biographer, Jan Swafford. The 12, 13, and 14-year-old Johannes was surrounded by the stench of beer and unwashed sailors, by the din of rough laughter and drunkenness and raving obscenity. He had to accompany the bawdy songs. He had to look at the sailors fondling the half-naked singing girls, and he had to participate as well. Between dances, the women would sit the prepubescent teenager on their laps and pour beer into him and pull down his pants and hand him around to be played with to general hilarity. There may have been much worse from the sailors, because Johannes was as fair and as pretty as a little girl, unquote. Well, no wonder Brahms fled from intimacy with women. No wonder he preferred the physical companionship of prostitutes. No wonder he would proudly claim later in his life that, quote, I have never made a married woman or a Fraulein unhappy, unquote. But of course, that's not true. It's not true at all. Because Brahms did indeed make a married and then widowed woman miserably unhappy. And that was Clara Schumann. With Brahms's departure in 1856, Clara was once again plunged into grieving. She wrote in her diary, when Johannes left me, my heart bled. On that day and the days that followed, I lived through those 3 years of suffering. She's referring to the institutionalization of her husband Robert and his death. I lived through those 3 years of suffering all over again. But amazingly, the bond between Brahms and Clara held. Brahms, Clara, and her kids vacationed together, and they dined together whenever they could. Clara remained a staunch supporter of Brahms's music and his confidant, even though he was often irked by her advice. When Brahms began to make real money as a touring composer and pianist in the 1860s, it was Clara who invested it for him. And quite well, it turns out, in stocks and securities. Piano Quartet in G Minor, Opus 25. Now, Brahms's mature compositional voice was fully in place by 1860, a compositional voice that brilliantly synthesized the objective and the subjective, a style that combined a direct, personal, and in all ways 19th-century romantic expressive voice with the intellectual discipline and formal structures of Viennese classicism of the 18th century. And no work better demonstrates Brahms's newly minted compositional maturity than this piano quartet in G minor composed in 1861 when he was 28 years old. The quartet is big music, big in length, big in sound, and populated by grand orchestral thematic ideas. Yes, by this point of his career, Brahms should have been composing orchestral music, symphonies and concerti, but he wasn't. Schumann's article, I trust we remember the article, The Curse, still had him by the short and curlies. So, his chamber music for strings and piano became his orchestral surrogate. Chamber works like the piano quartet in G minor and the piano quintet in F minor, that allowed him to explore an orchestral range of expressive content. Movement one, sonata form. The first movement, sonata form, begins with a lengthy and broadly conceived theme that plumbs a variety of moods, from quiet introspection at the beginning to explosive drama. Let's hear it. Theme one, movement one. Big music. Theme two is in reality a massive theme group as it consists of a number of different themes. It is a theme group that starts quietly and lyrically in D minor and then shifts to D major and concludes with a stomping syncopated peasant dance. Let's hear all of this material that constitutes theme two. Thank you. That's quite a theme. 80 measures long, huge. And all we've sampled so far are the principal themes. But it's also brilliantly wrought that no matter how long and no matter how different is the thematic material, every new event seems to make perfect sense, like listening to a great storyteller or rhetorician. And that's because, as we have already observed and are observing again, Brahms's music demonstrates almost constant thematic development. He was a master of taking small melodic ideas and progressively metamorphosing them, and by doing so, creating these rhetorical entities, these storylines, in which each new musical idea seems right as it follows the previous idea. Call it what you wish, varied unity, unified variety. Such an attention to compositional detail characterizes pretty much all of his music. Now, for Brahms's contemporaries, who didn't have all the time we have had to listen to these pieces and analyze them, for his contemporaries, this level of compositional intensity made his music difficult new music, which was why Clara's first impression of this first movement was negative. She wrote to Brahms, quote, "The first movement seems to me too little in G minor and too much in D major, and the absence of G minor makes it lack clarity," unquote. This is exactly the kind of comment she'd make that would make Brahms roll his eyes and look at the ceiling. It was Clara who played the piano part at the quartet's premiere on November 16th, 1861. And she wrote in her diary, "The quartet really only partially satisfies me. There's just too little unity in the first movement," unquote. But of course, the opposite is true. Everything is unified. Movement two. Brahms had originally entitled the second movement as being a scherzo. Like his Beethoven-created model, Brahms's movement is a three-part structure, ABA, set in triple meter. That means things go by in groups of three. However, at Clara's suggestion, Brahms retitled the movement Intermezzo, or Interlude. It's an altogether appropriate designation given the gentle and graceful character of the music. Let's hear the wispy, ethereal middle section, the B section of this movement. Movement three is a grand and lyric andante. We'll hear it in performance. And before we tackle the fourth movement, a little quick review. Date, August 1850. Place, the free city of Hamburg, the largest port city in what today is Germany. Protagonist number one, Johannes Brahms, a 17-year-old pianist, composer, and native of Hamburg. Protagonist number two, Eduard Remenyi, a 22-year-old violinist and Hungarian expat currently living in Hamburg. He performed both the traditional violin repertoire and so-called Hungarian gypsy music, a faux exotic and commercialized imitation of genuine Magyar folk music. The two, Brahms and Remenyi, met in August of 1850 when Brahms accompanied Remenyi at a private concert at the home of a local merchant. Brahms continued to gig with Remenyi and, through him, got to know the songs and dances that together made up the alla Zingarese, the in the gypsy style repertoire that Remenyi specialized in. Brahms was floored by this music, by the exotic, passionate, rhythmically exciting gypsy-style music that he played with Remenyi. The gypsy music was, in fact, for Brahms, a musical life-changer. So now, movement 4, Rondo. There is no better example of Brahms's Hungarian thang than the fourth movement, Rondo, of this piano quartet in G minor. Brahms labeled the movement Rondo alla Zingarese, Rondo in the gypsy style. It consists of a series of gypsy-style dance tunes, all of Brahms's creation, from the incredibly energized to the most droopingly mawkish. Now, we heard the energized Rondo theme at the beginning of today's session. Let's now sample the mawkish, the slow, soulful, absolutely tongue-in-cheek middle section of the movement. You know, with all due respect to the Hungarian Franz Liszt, no one wrote better Hungarian-style gypsy music in the 19th century than the German Johannes Brahms. Of this fourth movement, the Brahms scholar Malcolm MacDonald writes, quote, "The finale, Rondo alla Zingarese, belongs to a tradition of gypsy finales going back to Haydn. Yet its sheer animal vitality extends the tradition and is the most flamboyant and unbuttoned episode in Brahms's long love affair with the popular and exotic Hungarian idioms that he had imbibed from Remenyi." And we revisit Remenyi for just a moment. I would tell you that in life, his real name was Eduard Hoffmann. In life, Eduard Remenyi was an irksome creep. But credit where credit is due. We have Remenyi to thank for Brahms's affection for cafe gypsy music. But even more, if Remenyi, while on his concert tour with Brahms in 1853, hadn't walked away from Brahms in Weimar, Brahms would likely never have met Robert and Clara Schumann. And the events that have framed this series might never have taken place. So despite the fact that Remenyi, who, by the way, dropped dead in the middle of a recital here in San Francisco at the Orpheum Theater on May 15th, 1898, despite the fact that, there's a little factoid that we can't live without, huh? Despite the fact that Remenyi spent the remainder of his life claiming that Brahms had stolen all his gypsy tunes from him, we still have much to thank him for. Gwendolyn Mock joins members of the Alexander String Quartet in this performance of Johannes Brahms's Piano Quartet in G minor, Opus 25 of 1861. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Explorations in Music on KALW. Today's program featured Brahms Piano Quartet No. 1, Opus 25. Tune in next time when we hear Brahms Piano Quintet in F minor, Opus 34. Explorations in Music is produced for KALW by Eric Wayne in association with San Francisco Performances, the Alexander String Quartet, and Dr. Robert Greenberg. For more information about San Francisco Performances and their upcoming events, visit them on the web at sfperformances.org. The Alexander String Quartet are violinists Zacharias Grafilo and Frederick Lifsitz, violist Paul Yarbrough, and cellist Sandy Wilson. You can find out more and purchase recordings of the ASQ on their website, asq4.com. The lecturer was Dr. Robert Greenberg, music historian in residence at San Francisco Performances. The concerts were recorded at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. You can join us on Facebook by searching for Explorations in Music. Our email address is explorations@kalw.org. Thanks for listening. I'm David LaTulipe.